that there are things there in the dark. I'm not trying to be dramatic. This is the truth of the matter. There are things there in the dark that we probably can't control, that probably do want to harm us, and that we're not even fully aware of. And that's exactly where we find ourselves in the book of Esther today. We're in chapter 3. We'll look at chapters 3 and 4. And if you don't have a Bible, you can look up the Bible online. So grab your phone, Esther chapter 3, or grab the Bible from under the seat right in front of you. You'll find Esther 3 on page 411. Here's why I want you to look at that. I want you to know I'm not making this up. That's the honest truth. Some pastors stand in front of people and just speak, expecting that they're going to believe, everybody who hears them is going to believe what they're saying, because they're pastors and they're on the platform. I don't assume that at all. I'm thankful you would listen, but I want you to see that it's coming from the pages of the Bible. So 411 is the number where you need to be. Last week in chapters 1 and 2, we watched an arrogant king lose his temper, a beautiful queen lost her crown, and an unlikely orphan named Esther found a crown for herself as she was made queen. All the pieces just fall into place. There's nothing flashy, nothing miraculous, just the clear providence of a reigning God who refuses to be uninvolved even when he chooses to be unseen. That's what's going on in chapters 1 and 2. Today in chapters 3 and 4, the shadows get deeper. A new enemy steps onto the stage filled with hate and just bent on evil. The glitz and glamour of the Persian Empire that appears in chapters 1 and 2, that's all ripped away because one man turns the entire empire into a machine just bent on steamrolling the people of God into dust, being eliminated for history and forever. A monster really does dwell in the darkness, and in this chapter we learn his name. So if you're here this morning and you've been thinking, why does it feel like the problems in my life are so complicated, so deep? Why is our society so dysfunctional? There's got to be something at work out there beyond just my own inability and our society's inability to get better. If you've thought that, well, you're right. This story explains why the problems in the world sometimes feel truly supernaturally evil, because they are. If you're thinking, why do some people think it's so bad that I'm a Christian? I try to be reasonable. I try to be kind. I'm a good worker and a good neighbor. Why is it such a deficit in our relationship that I follow Jesus? Why do they hate that? Well, this story explains, in line with the rest of the story that the Bible's telling. And maybe you're here, you're not even a Christian. And when I talk about things lurking in the dark, and it sounds dramatic and whatever, but if there's something to that that resonates with you, because maybe you're not a Christian, but if you're honest, you have to feel your own vulnerability. Your health is not under your control. Your wealth is not under your control. Your future, they just aren't. I'm not trying to poke you in the eye. I'm just being honest. And so all of us sit here vulnerable. I hope you'll consider this story if you're not a Christian. What we'll learn in the story is it's normal as a human being to feel vulnerable and to feel like you need help beyond your own resources. And as we'll learn, there is help beyond your own resources. Perfectly placed, perfectly timed. So here's what we learn. The threat is real, the fear makes sense, and our hope comes down to one person willing to risk everything to save a people who cannot save themselves. Two chapters, chapter three, the crisis, and chapter 4, the call. There's a deadly threat exposed in chapter 3, and there's a deadly decision imposed in chapter 4. Let's look at it. Chapter 3, the crisis. After these things, I'm going to read a little bit and then explain, and read a little bit and explain. It's a story. It outlines itself. So I'm just going to read these first 6 verses, and then we'll talk about them for a moment. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hamadatha, advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. So the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day and he wouldn't listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, because he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Well, this is the problem that drives the entire book of Esther. And it seems like an overreaction, right? One guy gets insulted by another guy and decides he's going to wipe out that dude's entire ethnic group. That's strange. Why? Well, the key is in their identities. The king exalts Mordecai, and the narrator tells us that this guy is an Agagite. What is that? I mean, his father is Hammedatha. We don't know anything about Hammedatha, but Agag, is that name ringing a bell for you? That sound familiar? Do we know an Agag from anywhere else in the scriptures? It's an Agagite, the king of we don't know why. A king Ahasuerus promotes Haman to be in basically second position in the empire. He's the prime minister. And the king tells him, you need to show the prime minister special honor. You need to bow down to him. And all the king's servants and all the king's men and all the king's horses, they bow down to Haman, except for Mordecai. We're not told why Mordecai doesn't bow down. Some people think it's because he's a Jew and it would violate the first commandment. And that's just not a good argument because he's not making Haman God. Jews bow before their king frequently in the Bible. The reason seems to be his Jewish identity. Not that he's going to violate a command, but that he knows this guy's a punk. He gets a lot of his identity from having people bow to him, and I'm not going to do that, and he can't hurt me because I'm one of God's people. It seems to me that's what Mordecai's thinking because of how he talks to Esther later. So it does have something to do with the fact that he's a Jew, but not that bowing down would violate the Jewish law. So we've got a Jew and we've got an Agagite. Let's drill down on that Agagite business. Remember where that name shows up earlier? In 1 Samuel 15, the prophet Samuel goes to Saul and says to him, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up from Egypt. So go strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Don't spare them. Kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." And you read that in that moment and you're like, what? Kill this entire nation with all the kids? What is wrong with this picture? And then you have to go back further into the Bible story and figure out why. Well, the reason is in Exodus 17, when the children of Israel were traveling from Egypt to Mount Sinai to receive the law, they were tired and weary. They're in the middle of the wilderness. They're strung out like this long caravan. And one of the nations through by whom they passed started to attack, but not attack the soldiers and the leaders in front. They started to attack the kids and the weak and the slow and the tired and the sick, the people who were at the end of the wagon train. They started to kill them. In other words, and that was the nation of Amalek. In other words, they proved that they themselves were cowards and weaklings and cruel. The people who couldn't fight back became their victims. Israel never forgot that. In fact, God told them to never forget that. Listen to what God says in Deuteronomy 25. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you came out of Egypt. He attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind. He didn't fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around, in the land the Lord your God's giving you for an inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget." In other words, the Amalekites set the rules of engagement, not Israel. They're the ones who decided, you want to pull women and children into the battle? That's the kind of civilization you're going to be? That's not good for anyone. Now, yes, they attacked the wrong group of people, but with that ethos, with that culture, that's not safe for any other nation. And so God ordains that they be destroyed. He waits hundreds of years. From Deuteronomy to 1 Samuel, when Saul gets the order, go kill the Amalekites, hundreds of years pass when the Amalekites could have repented. Apparently they don't. So the Lord tells Saul, you go destroy them, as I said. And Saul does. Almost. Right? He wipes out their cities, but he saves the best of the animals. I mean, why wouldn't a king want to enrich himself a little? For sacrifice to God. And he lets their king survive, who has the odd, but in this story, important name, Agag. King Agag, the king of the Amalekites, survives. And apparently, at least one of his sons. Because that son gave birth to a son who eventually gave birth to a cat named Haman, who gets promoted to prime minister in the kingdom of Persia. Unless you think this is just a showdown between Haman the Agagite and some Jew, look back at Mordecai's identity, Esther chapter 2, verse 5. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Who else do we know who was a son of Kish, a Benjaminite? Saul. This is Saul versus Agag. This isn't just Haman versus Mordecai. This is an ancient conflict that's even bigger than Saul versus Agag. This is Israel versus Amalek. It's God versus sheer evil. That's what it is. It's no wonder things got so intense so fast. This is no petty rivalry. This isn't some prime minister who goes, everybody needs to bow to me, even you. This isn't just that. This is an age-old hatred. This is an ancient enemy with an ancient history who has always had murder in their hearts and annihilation as their goal, and it was always their practice to start with the weakest. Those people are not fit for the world. They need to be wiped out. And Haman proves it. As soon as one of them gets in power again, he wants to destroy everybody. So Haman sets a date, verse 7. In the first month, in the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is in the month of Adar. Cast lots, it means they rolled the dice to decide what would be the best time. It makes it sound a little bit the way the ESV translates it, like every day they would roll the dice to see if today was the day. That's not what's being described. What's being described is they would point to a date on the calendar and roll the dice, and but when the dice finally came up favorable, that was the date. They did it all on one day, trying to choose. In other words, it's Haman being superstitious, trying to invoke the blessing of the gods. He's prime minister, but he knows he doesn't have all authority and all power. So he's rolling the dice to find out superstitiously which would be the most fortunate day to bring this down on the heads of the Jews. And they choose a date several months down the road. Verse 7 tells us that this is the first month, and they roll the dice and land on the 12th month. The 13th day, we learn a few verses later. Haman knows that it's not going to be easy to pull off a destruction of the Jews in the Empire of Persia. Do you remember how some of the Persian kings have treated the Jews? Pretty well. Right? Remember Cyrus? He was the king that said, if you're from Jerusalem, you can return to the Promised Land. That's fine. Do you remember Darius? Ezra chapter 6 tells us that Darius, who was Xerxes' father, King Ahasuerus, his other name is Xerxes. Ahasuerus' own father funded the rebuilding of the Jewish temple out of the Persian Empire's personal treasury, the king's treasury. He funded the rebuilding of the Jewish temple. And now, Xerxes' prime minister wants to kill all the Jews. He knows he needs some supernatural power. And you as a reader are thinking, if you've got this backdrop, historical backdrop in your head, you're thinking, wow, maybe this prime minister will be just isolated and marginalized in his murderous intention. The Persian Empire is an okay place for Jews to live. Maybe they'll find protection in a benevolent empire. It's really helped them in the past. Maybe it'll help them now. Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they don't keep the king's laws. So it's not to the king's profit to tolerate them." Just stop there. He starts with a truth, then he moves to a half-truth, then he starts telling lies. This is how it always goes when you want to demonize someone. Start with something true. There's a lot of them, and they're away from their homeland, and they're sort of all around us. They're dispersed through the whole kingdom. Then he says a half-truth. They have different laws from us. The reason that's a half-truth is, of course, it's true, but in this context, it makes it sound like they're suspicious. They might even be seditious. They've got different laws. And the thing the Medes and the Persians were famous for was their laws, the law of the Medes and the Persians. We still use that phrase today. He says, they have different laws. Well, we know one of the Jews' own prophets, Jeremiah, wrote them a letter from God, and it said, make sure that you seek the welfare of the city where you are living in exile. Remember that, Jeremiah 29? It's the verse that comes a few verses before, the one that's on every graduation card. I know the plans that I have for you, plans to prosper you, give you a hope and a future. A few verses before that, Jeremiah, who's writing to people in exile, not people whose best life is now, tells them, you should do good to the city where you're living. And the Jews who lived all over the empire, there were some in Egypt, there were some still in Babylon. We know there's a bunch in Susa. They were seeking the blessing of the city where they lived. I mean, Mordecai himself has been promoted to some capacity in the government. And then he tells an outright lie. They don't keep the king's laws. Well, Esther did. All contrary to her Jewish identity, she submitted to this reaping of young virgins and went and slept with the king. I mean, and this last line, it's not to the king's profit to tolerate them. There was a story just a few paragraphs earlier about a certain guy that saved the king's life. Who was that? Oh, that was one of the Jews. It is to the king's benefit to have Jews around. Haman's lying. But he keeps on. He doesn't just lie about them. He starts to flatter and bribe the king. Verse 9, if it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it in the king's treasuries. Well, that was convincing. Verse 10. So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said, the money's given to you, and the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. So it seems like Haman's proposal is, I'll wipe them out, I'll take their money, I'll pay 10,000 talents to you, which some scholars estimate, that's a massive sum. Some scholars estimate that was 60% of the king's annual revenues from tax through the whole empire. Now that's a pretty big boost. Hard to say no to that. The king says to Haman, basically, thanks for the tip. Do what you want. Kill the people, keep the money. Verse 12, the machinery of the whole empire kicks into action to crush the Jews. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and governors over the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples. To every province in its own script and every people in its own language, it was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces. Here's the ethos of the Amalekites, in case you think this is something that just happens politically. Look at the evil of this. Verse 13, letters to all the provinces with instruction to destroy and kill and annihilate all Jews, young and old, women, and children in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And then look at this last sentence. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. One mark of a truly wicked ruler is his callousness to the fate of the people under his rule. Here's a king whose reign, his responsibility, and these Persian kings have demonstrated they know that. His responsibility is to help, to do all he can to support the people under his kingdom, because happy citizens make for a happy kingdom. This guy has no idea that even in his hometown, there's mayhem in the streets, and it's not just the Jews. All of Susa seems to recognize, what? This is awful. And the king sits down to have a banquet. The whole book of Esther centers on banqueting, doesn't it? There's a huge feast at the beginning in chapter 1. There's a feast when Esther's crowned king. There's banqueting here. Esther invites the king to a banquet in a moment. When that banquet goes well, there's a feast for all the Jews all through the empire. You can eat your way through this book. So the king and Haman are completely callous, unaware of the mayhem in the city. But in chapter 4, a call. There's a deadly crisis that falls on God's people and in chapter 3. And in chapter 4, there is a deadly call that comes to one. But let's start in verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and cried out with a loud, bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and decrees reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. You see what the narrator's doing for us. Mordecai is, in some measure, in a position of power. He's one of the king's men. He has access to the court. But he leaves because he's in mourning, and it's not legal to be in mourning in that location. But it's not just that. Verse 3 tells us he's identifying with his people, isn't he? Everywhere else through the empire, they're in sackcloth and mourning and weeping. And he goes out into the city, away from his position of influence, and weeps in sackcloth and ashes. He's identifying with his people. There's weeping all through the empire, except in the actual castle. Look at verse 4. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came, told her, the queen was deeply distressed. About what? Well, she sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth. Oh. She's distressed that he's acting like that. But he wouldn't accept them. So Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and learn what this was and why. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square in the city in the front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, so that the eunuch, he, the messenger, might show it to Esther and explain to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. There is this awkward narrative element of messengers that holds all of chapter 4 together. Mordecai and Esther never see each other face to face, and yet they speak to each other through messengers. Why? It's super easy to overlook that little detail, but it's so important not to. Because it demonstrates that he's out in the city identifying with his people. She's still protected by the castle. She's got a throne and a crown, and the messengers going back and forth illustrate the distance between them. He's identified with his people. The question is, will she? That's the challenge. He's exposed and vulnerable, and he's identified himself as a Jew. She's cloistered away in the halls of power. So he does two things. He informs her of the threat with documentation, and he instructs her, go to the king, beg for help, or it's all over with us. Now notice in verse 10, the narrator, instead of telling us what happens, starts to let us listen in as the characters themselves speak. Why? Because it draws us in deeper. We identify with these characters. It provokes our imagination. We're not just listening to a narrator. We're listening to Esther and to Mordecai. And it's really important what they say. Verse 10, then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I've not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And they went and told Mordecai what Esther said. You get her point, right? She's like, dude, I have way less power than you think. I have way less access than you'd think. I have way less personal favor than you'd think. He hasn't wanted me in a month. In any way, he hasn't wanted me. Remember in chapter 1 when the king has the problem with Vashti and the narrator goes out of his way to elaborate on the 7 advisors who counsel the king, and they say they saw, the narrator says, those guys saw the king's face. There were 7 people in the kingdom who had free access to the king. It wasn't her. She's like everybody else when it comes to this. Like everybody else. Great risk if she goes before the king and is not welcomed. Esther's the only character in this story who's given 2 names. Hadassah, which seems to refer to a flowering plant, and Esther, which means hidden. A lot of scholars see significance in the fact that this one character has 2 names. And she's the one who has to decide, which version of myself will I be? Verse 13, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Friends, this is Mordecai's only speech in the book of Esther. We don't hear any other words out of his mouth other than these. And they're probably the most important words in the book, aren't they? The whole narrative turns on this and Esther's speech to follow. He says to Esther, if you won't step up, deliverance will come from somewhere else and you'll still go down. How can he be so sure? Well, because there's a covenant in place with the Jews, isn't there? He's falling back on God's promise to Abraham that in you, Abraham, all nations of the earth will be blessed. The Jews have to survive. But those who curse you, God will curse, God said to Abraham. Mordecai just leverages that in his conversation with his cousin. We will be saved. No one can oppose God's people. We have a covenant. And you know what's weird? Haman's own wife seems to understand that. Look at chapter 6. Carl will develop this next week. But if you look at chapter 6, verse 13, Haman's own wife says to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him. You will fall before him. This seems to be a known reality that the Jews have the support of God himself. And Mordecai leverages that. In other words, the book of Galatians calls the Abrahamic covenant the gospel. And so what Mordecai says to Esther is just the gospel. No one can destroy us. I might die and you might die, but our nation will survive. And this edict is trying to wipe out our entire people. That's not gonna happen. Somebody's gonna save us. It might be you, but if it's not you, you're indirectly cursing us and God will deal with you, is what he says to her. That gets her attention. Verse 15, Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, day or night, night or day. I and my young women will fast as you do, and then I will go to the king, though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Fourteen times in this book, this woman is called Queen Esther. 13 of them come after this moment. This is when this woman steps up and assumes the identity that God's called her to. It's a breathtaking, glorious, audacious, profoundly risky moment. It's right for the Jews to honor her through all of history. It's right for moms to name their little girls Esther. This is a remarkable moment, an awesome moment. But it's only a shadow, friends, isn't it? It's not the moment. Esther's not the character who parallels us in our own lives. We're the poor little Jews sitting in their cottages going, sure hope somebody in the kingdom is going to help me out, because if not, I'm getting steamrolled. This is it for me and my family, right? That's who we are. Talk more about that in just a second. But look at verse 17. Mordecai went and did everything as Esther ordered him. Now she's telling him what to do, and he's obeying her. And the story ends on a cliffhanger. How's this going to go? Well, most of you have heard the story, so you know. But we're just going to stop here. And Carl gets the great joy of relieving all the tension for us in chapters 5-7. But let me just give you the point of this story. It's basically what I said in the introduction, that there truly is a monster who dwells in the darkness, a very real enemy who wants to destroy you. Hearing that in and of itself can be a shock. Today is the anniversary of 84 years ago, Pearl Harbor, on a Sunday morning, Japanese planes dive bombing and destroying the entire Pacific Fleet in Hawaii. It was a complete shock to the American people to realize that we had an enemy who wanted to kill us. It can be a shock to hear from this story, hey guys, you know what the point of the story is? There truly is a monster in the darkness who wants to destroy you. If you wake up tomorrow morning and call yourself a Christian, there are people and powers in this world who want to kill you. That's the point of the story. I'm supposed to be a preacher called of God to give you his word. I can't say less to you than that. It's not a happy thing to hear. But it's irresponsible of me not to tell you. We just don't think about this very often, do we? And when we do think about it, we tend to misidentify the enemy. Jesus came and waged war at its root against sin, death, and the devil. Those are the enemies. It's not people who disagree with us politically because of the first word, people. They're people like us made in the image of God, right? Ephesians 6 says, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. John 8:44 says the devil is the father of lies. You see him hovering behind Haman in this story, don't you? Bent on destroying the people of God, speaking lies about them to other people in power. That's what the devil does. That's what this story's about. That kind of supernatural evil. So what do we do with this? Well, there are two applications, and they're the same two with a different form from the last Sunday. Don't be deceived and don't be dismayed. Don't be deceived. We need to see these chapters. We need to see what's happening in these chapters so that our eyes are opened to this reality in our world. Our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world are certainly aware of this, aren't they? In Nigeria, in North Korea, in Sudan, in Somalia, there are Christians in other parts of the world who are dying every day because they know that if they wake up tomorrow and identify as Christians, there are people and powers in this world that want to kill them. And so for us to sit here and go, gosh, that's shocking, is to show zero empathy for your brothers and sisters whom you will meet in glory someday. Friends, let's not have that kind of naivety and selfishness. But it's not just about them. There is an underlying hatred toward God, an underlying suspicion of God's people that animates the entire world culture that is not Christian. It's just there. John 15, Jesus said, if you were of the world would love you. But because you're not of the world, I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. A servant's not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. But all these things they will do to you on account of me, because they don't know the one who sent me. In the book of Acts, when the church was truly persecuted, not had their tax-exempt status taken away, when they were truly persecuted, they recognized that it was the battle between good and evil, God and the devil, not just people being mean to us. They went to Psalm 2, and they quoted Psalm 2 in prayer to the Lord and said, why do the heathen rage and the kings rebel against your anointed? Friends, it's only to the extent that we identify with Jesus and suffer that this is good versus evil. It's not any political party, it's not any political position that we identify with and suffer. It's Jesus that we identify with and suffer. And so at a personal level, we cannot be offended at people who don't like us or our Christianity. And at a community level, we cannot possibly trust an apparently benevolent, but ultimately pagan human empire. We cannot trust it. Persia was kind to the Jews until they weren't. Guys, this is why when I talk about politics, it seems like I'm punching right. Because the temptation in our church, for most of us, is to align ourselves to the right. And I have no problem with you voting and caring about political things and being on the right or the left or whatever. I truly don't care about that. I care about the morality of the Bible. What I do care about is if you trust that that alliance is going to help the cause of Christ in any way. The problem's not the people, that we've got the right people in government and then there could be the wrong people in government. The problem is the system itself. It's all too human and it could turn on a dime. And if we trust it to get things done that we think will help God's cause, and then it turns against us, not only will we be surprised, we'll be profoundly unprepared. We won't ever have learned how to pray. We won't ever have learned how to wage spiritual warfare. We won't ever have learned how to suffer. We won't ever have learned how to tell our neighbors about the gospel because we think Washington is going to help us be good Christians. It never will. That's what I mean when I punch right. When you get to the book of Revelation, which we will in just a month, I don't want us to be embarrassed to notice that there are three great enemies of God's people. There's the harlot, Babylon, a world system that tends to seduce us. There's the false prophet who tends to deceive us. And there's the beast who wants to devour us. What's that? It's government. In the book of Revelation, it's Rome, seven hills, which are seven kings. In our lives, it's still human government, and they're all animated by the devil. The dragon stands behind all of them. Sometimes he's more dragonish than others because you've got a government that wants to kill Christians. Sometimes he pulls back a little, but you still have a government that is up to its own work, not the work of God's kingdom. That's why I punch right. Because I don't want us to think that's going to help us. It never will. Persia turned on a dime. And so could Washington. So let's not trust it. That's all I'm trying to say. Is that okay? With some of you. I'll still get emails from some others. But that's okay. That's my job. To say what I think the Bible says and then get emails. Second application. Don't be deceived. Second application, don't be dismayed. Don't be dismayed. Why? Are we under the sentence of death? Absolutely. Are we facing enemies in the darkness that we have no power to defeat? Absolutely. Sin, death, and the devil. We need someone to enter the halls of power, plead for us, put himself at risk and wage war for us, defeat our enemy and deliver us. Do we have anyone like that? Yes, because just like this story gives us the name of evil, Haman, it also implies the name of our deliverer, not Esther, but the one whom she foreshadows, Jesus of Nazareth. There are so many analogies. to Esther's story and Jesus. There's so many coincidences in this book, right? Esther just happened to be made queen after Vashti just happened to be deposed because the king just happened to get mad, and Mordecai just happens to stumble on a plot for the king, and the New Testament picks up that language. That thing that Mordecai said to Esther, who knows if you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? The New Testament picks that up twice, applies it to Jesus. Galatians 4:4, when the fullness of time had come, there was born of a woman, born under the law, to save those under the law. Some versions translate that at just the right time. Romans 5:6 says exactly that. While we were still weak, at just the right time, Jesus died for the ungodly. There's our Esther, right? Stepping up. There are all these analogies, but what a profound contrast. No hesitation by Jesus to identify with his people. None. No concern about whether he might die. He knew he was going to die. So is there a connection between us and Esther? Sure. We can act in faith and courage and obedience, knowing that God's providence is carrying us along, but that's not the main application. The main application is just be grateful, collapse in trust and hope and joy at the advocacy of Jesus who defeated sin, death, and the devil for you. Because friends, our celebration of Advent is not hiding from the darkness or denying it's real. Our celebration of the Advent is just the proud, loud proclamation that we are no longer alone in the darkness. Amen. Father, I pray for you to take this book, wrap it up like an arrow, send it deep in our hearts, and put our hope in Jesus alone who can save his people. In his name I pray. Amen.